wedding is the scene of political violence in Afghanistan. ISIS targeted a minority group, the Hazara, who've been trying to get their voices heard in the ongoing talks to end the 18-year-old war.
You have to be represented in these peace talks, but whose idea of religion and Islam are we trying to bring to apply to everyone in this society?
I'm Carol Hills. ISIS, the Taliban, and Afghans who just want peace. Also today, we travel to Ghana, 400 years after African slavery began in the American colonies. And a festival in the UK names its annual funniest joke.
Oh, boy. Come on. Really?
It's puns. You know, Brits love their puns. We think they're punny.
Maybe you had to be there. Those stories ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. Today was supposed to be a day of celebration in Afghanistan, 100 years since the country gained its independence from Britain. But Afghan President Ashraf Ghani postponed the festivities because the country is in mourning. Over the weekend, a suicide bombing killed 63 people at the wedding of a young Hazara couple in Kabul. The bride and groom survived, but many of their friends and family were among the dead and wounded. In a televised speech today, President Ghani vowed to avenge them. He said, "Unfortunately, the enemies of our country are so cowardly and weak that they carried out a brutal terrorist attack on a wedding party. They targeted a completely civilian place and attacked our children and women." ISIS has claimed responsibility for the attack. In Afghanistan, members of the Hazara ethnic minority have often been targeted by extremists. Lena Torrey-Jan is a student at the University of Richmond. She's Hazara and grew up in Afghanistan. Lena, what was your reaction to the tragedy this weekend?
I have to say it was just another really sad situation. I live 45 minutes away from it when I was in Afghanistan. It's very real. It's inhumane, especially that it has been targeted towards a specific group. It makes this like a persecution and a genocide towards the Shia people and the Hazara people.
What was your experience as a Hazara growing up in Afghanistan?
It was hard. It was hard because my parents were refugees in Iran and they came back to Afghanistan after being treated poorly. And when they returned, it was during the Taliban regime. So I grew up in basements and hiding places as a five-year-old. I could not understand why I couldn't go outside. My dad would always tell me, "My child, your Asian features, you know, your eyes, your nose, this is a sign that people can identify you as Hazara and you're the target." So it was hard as a child. When people ask me of my earliest childhood memories, I only can share about being hiding in basements. It was a crime to be a Hazara. And to this day, the way that attack is happening, it still makes you a criminal to be a Hazara or to be a Shia in Afghanistan.
How does an attack like the one that happened over the weekend at this wedding, how does it affect the community?
63 lives have been taken, but hundreds and thousands of lives are going to have to live with this for the rest of their life. What makes it very scary is that this attack is targeting a specific ethnic group. Because to us, for Hazara and Shia people, it's just another sign that Afghanistan has not advanced. We're still living during the Taliban times when the massacre of Hazara people and the Shia people were just declared and was allowed to happen. So it's a scary situation for us. But unfortunately, the reality is we're going to move on and then we're going to shut up until another attack like this happens.
The U.S. and the Taliban are currently holding peace talks. Do you know whether any of those concerns are being addressed, the concerns of the Hazara community at these talks?
To this day, not really. People are not hearing. We've had leaders who are represented there, but to be realistic, I feel like they're just a token there. They're just put there to represent. I don't really think they have a say. I don't think they're even being heard. The government officials are saying that this peace process is inclusive, but representation is not a question. Are we talking about the actual issues, about uncomfortable discussions and conversation of what is going on in Afghanistan? No, we're not. I feel like it's a very rushed decision. U.S. withdrawal to bring the Taliban back into these peace talks without any realistic transition or a solid plan.
Lena Torrey-Jan is a student at the University of Richmond. She's a Hazara and grew up in Afghanistan. Thanks a lot, Lena.
Of course. Have a nice day.
The Trump administration thinks the U.S. is spending too much on foreign aid, and it's proposing to cut $4 billion in federal aid spending. The White House is getting some bipartisan pushback on that. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi actually says the cuts could be illegal. So how much does the U.S. actually spend on foreign aid? Most of us don't really have a handle on that. Some think it's about 30% of the federal budget. Others guess it's more like 50%. Steve O'Connell was the chief economist at USAID during the Obama administration. He joins us from Swarthmore College in Pennsylvania. Steve, let's clear this up right now. What percent of the federal budget does the U.S. spend on foreign aid?
Carol, we spend about 1% of the federal budget on foreign aid, and that includes the economic and development assistance part, and a part that is labeled security spending, but is also under the same budget.
So military aid to other countries also comes under that?
No, most military aid doesn't come under that. But there's some military assistance, military-related assistance, that is classified as non-military U.S. assistance.
And what's the purpose of foreign aid?
I think it probably has two or three purposes. So we spend on a broad range of what you might call human development efforts. The biggest dollar we spend is on international aid for health, maternal and child health, HIV/AIDS, tuberculosis, malaria. And then we spend on a variety of other forms of assistance for development, infrastructure in support of foreign trade, our Food for Peace program, development of the power sector in Africa, a whole variety of programs.
Critics say the money that goes to foreign aid would be better spent at home, looking after, say, veterans or the homeless. What's your response to that?
Well, we don't spend much on foreign assistance. And so my main response is that we need to right size our obligation and evaluate it from a kind of cost benefit perspective. We spend so little. There's such a strong bipartisan consensus at the Defense Department, I should say, that this foreign assistance spending is complementary to our military spending in terms of our own security. I don't think it's an either or, given how small the budget is.
You keep saying the U.S. foreign aid budget is small. How does it compare to what other wealthy countries spend?
Well, we're a big country. We're a rich country. So in terms of total amount spent, we're at the top of the league tables. In terms of spending as a share of national income, we're at the bottom of those tables. We spend about 0.15% of our income on foreign aid. And the notional UN target is 0.7%.
So to translate, you're saying that in real dollars, we spend the most because a little under 1% is 1% of our giant income. But smaller countries, they may not spend as much in real dollars, but based on the percentage of their income, they're spending more.
I would add one thing. So you could argue that the U.S. is not particularly generous in this mode, if you want to just compare it to our income. Nonetheless, because we are a big, rich economy, the ways we choose to spend our money have impact. We're often the biggest player on the ground in the key areas where we decide to concentrate our resources. So we're in a position where for us to back off of our admittedly low percentage contribution could really be losing a position of leadership and leverage that we've had by virtue of our big size.
Steve O'Connell was the chief economist at USAID during the Obama administration. Thanks a lot, Steve.
Thanks very much, Carol.
Patients having to wait longer for medicines, fresh food becoming less available, a hard Irish border, and long delays at ports and airports. These are some of the predictions in a British government document codenamed Operation Yellowhammer. It details a worst-case scenario if Britain leaves the EU without a deal on October 31st. The document was leaked to a newspaper in London, where the world's Orla Barry joins us. Orla, what's the reaction to this document been?
Well, in many ways, Carol, it depends on who you listen to. So if you're to listen to Conservative MPs today, they will tell you it's an old document. It was drawn up by Theresa May's government. You have people like Michael Gove, the minister in charge of planning for a no-deal Brexit, saying that it only paints the worst possible picture.
It is the case, as everyone knows, that if we do have a no-deal exit, there will inevitably be some disruption, some bumps in the road. But it is also the case that the UK government is far more prepared now than it was in the past. And it's also important for people to recognise that what's being described in these documents is emphatically a worst-case scenario.
OK, well, he's putting up a good front about it. But what about a Liberal MPs? How are they feeling?
Yeah, they're not feeling as optimistic. Take a listen to Tom Brake with the Liberal Democrats, who said, essentially, it sounds like something from wartime Britain.
We are talking about food, fuel and medicines shortages. That's the sort of thing that we talk about in wartime. This is something that is potentially going to happen in peacetime as a result of a conscious decision by our Prime Minister to do or die, for which he doesn't want to be held accountable. He's not willing to come to Parliament to defend himself.
And 100 MPs came together to ask Parliament to reconvene earlier than September 3rd, because the Parliament isn't due to come back until the start of September, and the government has turned down their request.
The report does sound pretty dire. What are industry groups in Britain saying?
From a business perspective, and a lot of the business organisations have been appealing to the government not to go down the road of a no-deal Brexit, they have said that this worst-case scenario is, well, worse than what they had thought. It was interesting, I was listening to a chap from the pharmaceutical industry, because medicines in particular is something that a lot of ordinary people are quite concerned about, whether they're going to get their medicine on time. They've talked about people with diabetes, for example, that their insulin might be delayed. And one chap from the pharmaceutical industry said it mightn't actually be an issue with the industries themselves and the ports and all of that. It might be led by the public, where the public becomes so fearful of not getting their hands on the medicine, they start stockpiling, and that naturally leads to a shortage of medicine. So this kind of fear grows and creates greater fear among the general public and worsens the situation.
Has Prime Minister Boris Johnson himself responded yet to this leak?
He didn't quite get into the specifics of it. He just said today that the government was preparing for a no deal scenario, that we would be leaving on October 31st, deal or no deal, but it may not be a smooth road ahead.
We're very confident that by October the 31st, we will be ready. And that's the crucial thing. I think that's what people want. You know, people are very confident themselves that they can do it. I'm not pretending that there won't be bumps on the road. There will be. I said that on the steps of Downing Street. But if everybody puts their minds to it, I have absolutely no doubt that we can get ready.
And of course, the G7 summit is happening later this week, and Boris Johnson will meet with other leaders for the first time there. I mean, is he expected to get some blowback about this?
Well, I'm sure he will. He said that he would talk to them about other issues other than Brexit. But I can only imagine that for most people, they'll want to know what was said about Brexit at it. It is his first time meeting other EU leaders. It's taken him this length of time, which is unusual. Usually when you have a UK Prime Minister starting out in office, there will be some early trips to meet other EU leaders. It hasn't happened. And the optics are, you know, quite obvious that he didn't want to be seen to be meeting with them because he had nothing to offer. And they, by all accounts, have very little to offer him. He was saying today that he's confident the EU has shifted its position on the backstop and that there will be negotiations, etc., taking place. The EU itself has said that, you know, the deal that was in place is still the deal. But indications are that those meetings will be maybe a little less smooth than he would have hoped.
The World's Orla Barry in London. Thanks, Orla.
Thanks, Carl.
Sounds like the UK could use some cheering up. Later this hour, an annual award for the best joke at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. You're listening to The World. I'm Carol Hills, and you're with The World. We've seen a rise in migrants and asylum seekers at the U.S.-Mexico border. Many come from Guatemala and head to places in the U.S. where they know people, places like Oakland, California. And some speak an indigenous language called Mam. It's creating a language gap for people who want to help the newcomers. KQED's Farida Jabvila-Romero went to a class where English and Spanish speakers are learning the Mam language.
And then call the tea, Arturo.
A handful of adults sit in the Latinx Cultural Center at Laney Community College in Oakland. They practice saying good afternoon in Mam with teacher Henry Sales. Later, Sales writes on the whiteboard, "Let's go eat," and shows students word by word.
Lol.
Lol.
The students laugh at themselves through practice. It's not easy to find a place to learn mom in the United States. So Mirta Ninayawar is glad this class now exists. She volunteers at a Sunday school where many of the kids only speak mom.
I want them to hear me speak mom so that they see that I'm also learning and trying hard to learn a different language, because that's what they're doing.
She wants the kids to feel proud of their language and culture.
I say Bante Shleha for good afternoon. I hope I said that right. And then Chonti is really easy because that's thank you. And we always try to teach the kids good manners.
It helps the kids open up, she says. They trust her more.
And even the parents, too, if I greet them and mom, they smile. And I think they feel that I care more about them.
There's no official count of mom people in the United States. The first waves of mom Guatemalans began arriving in Oakland, at least, in the 1980s, during that country's civil war. Since then, the community has grown rapidly to at least several thousand in Oakland, as more people have migrated from Guatemala, leaving extreme poverty and gang violence. And as more mom speakers come, the city needs people able to talk to them, to connect them to schools and services.
As there's so many newcomers, they're having a great need to serve those people, and what they found out is that they don't speak Spanish necessarily.
Arturo Davila is a Spanish professor that coordinates the Latinx Cultural Center at Laney College. He says they've gotten requests for mom interpreters.
Interpreters for medical clinics or legal clinics.
In some ways, people from the mom community are finding Oakland more accepting of their indigenous culture than their home country, says mom teacher Henry Sales. He's 25 years old and also works as an interpreter in immigration court.
Now that I'm here, I understand my rights and I understand like who we are. And now I feel proud and I will teach anyone who would like to learn the language.
It's not easy for mom speakers new to the United States, and especially the Bay Area. Housing is very expensive. Families cram together in small apartments. And it can just be hard to navigate life here if you don't speak English or Spanish. But Sales thinks he and this class can help change that.
I love it. I love, you know, connecting communities.
At the end of class, Sales writes down the phrase for any questions.
Oh my gosh.
Look at this.
Oh man.
One word has four consonants together.
You make it look so easy.
But then, after practice, they get it. For The World, I'm Farida Javala Romero, Oakland, California.
After more than three decades in power, the former president of Sudan seemed invincible. But today, Omar al-Bashir appeared unshaven in a courtroom in Khartoum. Bashir faces charges of corruption, possessing foreign currency, and receiving illegal gifts. The former president listened to the charges against him from inside a metal cage. A popular uprising forced Bashir from power in April. And just this weekend, protest leaders and the military officially signed a power-sharing deal.
The capital was just people celebrating. It was just one huge party. It was a sight to see.
Khartoum resident Dalia Abdelmonim was part of those protests that brought down Bashir. She's been watching his trial, and so far, she's unimpressed.
I have no faith in this court case, and in my opinion, it's going to become like another Mubarak trial, the former Egyptian president. It's just farcical, so I have no hopes for it whatsoever.
You mentioned Hosni Mubarak. He faced trial after the popular uprising in Egypt in 2011. He was freed in 2017. But I'm wondering, is the simple fact that Bashir is standing trial today, he's in the defendant's box, or in this case, he's actually in a cage in the courtroom, isn't that in and of itself cause for activists like you to celebrate today?
It is, but the harm that he inflicted on this country for 30 years, the corruption on a personal basis for him, it's just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, what about the 300,000 people who lost their lives in Darfur? Don't they have a right to get justice, or those who were displaced? What about the mass statewide corruption, you know? He claimed that he was given money by the late king of Saudi Arabia. I mean, who gives a $30 million gift if it was a gift. And then he's like, oh, I gave it to charity. They're trying to placate us, but it's not really working.
You were talking about the huge amounts of cash that were found at Bashir's residence after he was toppled, and the cash he's admitted he received from Saudi Arabia. I think it was $90 million in cash from Saudi Arabia, $25 million from Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman.
Yeah, the total sum was $90
million. Weren't those amounts themselves pretty shocking to Sudanese?
It is shocking, but it's nothing in terms of his own personal wealth. When the WikiLeaks cables came out, Bashir was estimated to have $9 billion. What about all the money that they have stashed abroad, for example?
Now, this trial in Khartoum is happening just as Sudan's military rulers and protest leaders are trying to implement a deal they struck earlier this month to achieve civilian rule. How's that going?
It's fine. I mean, it's showing we are taking the steps towards the civilian rule that we've all been calling for and demanding. So I'm happy. I think it's a very good indicator of how the next few years will be like for us. You know, for this country to move forward, we have to take those steps towards civilian rule. Everything that's being said is music to my ears, so to speak. But I'm excited about it, but I'm not celebrating it as of yet. There's still a lot of work to be done.
You know many families who lost friends and relatives in those months of protest in Sudan. What are those people thinking and feeling today as Omar al-Bashir is in court, basically in a cage?
There is a little sense of satisfaction, but not fully, because so many people were arbitrarily disappeared. So many people were forced to leave. So many people were killed. So whether we will heal as a country, it will take time. But I'm hoping if justice is served, you know, then that will be, you know, that will allow people to have closure. There are still some families who have no idea where their loved ones were buried. And this is like from 30 years ago, and they still haven't forgotten. So it's going to take a long time for us to be able to heal properly from the after effects of the Bashir regime. But getting justice is one way of allowing us to get to that point.
Khartoum resident Dalia Abdelmonim is an activist who was part of the protests that forced Omar al-Bashir from power. Thanks a lot, Dalia.
Thank you.
A researcher in Ghana digs into the origins of American slavery. For her, it's personal. It involves her ancestors, both European and African.
This will sound like I'm avoiding it, but I think I need time to process this.
It's been 400 years since the first enslaved Africans arrived in what became the U.S. I'm Carol Hills. That's ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH, PRI, and PRX. This week marks 400 years since the forced arrival of the first enslaved Africans in the American colonies. Historians say August 25th, 1619 was likely the date. And so this week, we're going to be hearing stories about where it all began, Africa, by our own Rupa Shenoy. Rupa's been looking at how people today are still linked to that past, and to start, she's focusing on one person in particular.
I first met Rachel last fall when I drove out to see her in central Massachusetts.
What got you interested in her in the first place?
I saw an article she wrote about her work in Ghana. Rachel is Ghanaian and English. She grew up in Singapore, and now she's a professor at Hampshire College in Massachusetts. And she wrote about finding her own name at a slave castle where she's doing an archaeological dig.
Her own actual last name?
Yeah, her name is Rachel Engman, and she found that name, Engman, and that led her to some surprising discoveries about her own family history. So we had coffee and agreed to meet again at the dig site in Ghana's capital, Accra, and that's how I ended up going to West Africa.
And that's where this story starts?
That's where the story starts. Right in the middle of Accra's coastline, there's a UNESCO World Heritage Site, a castle with a wall around it.
Hi, welcome to Ghana. Nice to see you.
We meet Rachel Engman just outside and walk together through a checkpoint. Inside is Christiansborg Castle, a stone building 3 stories tall with arched windows. It's painted so white it almost seems to glow in the sun. The lower levels are the dungeons where many captive Africans died in cave-like cells with low ceilings.
It feels like you're suffocating here.
The Dutch had this place built. In the 1600s and 1700s, they used it to transport and sell 125,000 Africans into slavery, most in what today is the U.S. Virgin Islands.
I wouldn't stay here after nightfall, after dark. I always leave at about 5:30, 6. Even if I have to do something in the office, I never stay late.
Do you know what you're scared of?
Ghosts, yeah, ghosts. People hear sounds, people hear footsteps, people hear crying. So I won't stay here late.
Rachel was raised in Singapore and began visiting here in 2005. One of her Ghanaian aunts told her there was something at this castle she should see.
And so she said to me, oh, you know, you're interested in culture, you should go to the castle and see, she said, see your name on the wall. So, of course, my surname is her surname, but when she relayed it to me, she said my, she didn't say our surname, she said my surname.
Rachel found the name in the castle courtyard, inscribed on the side of a water cistern. It said Carl Gustav Engman, 1757. Rachel had heard of a person with that name in her family history, a Danish man who came here when the Danes occupied the area.
I'd grown up with the understanding that he was a missionary.
That was the family lore. But Rachel found Carl Gustav Engman's papers in the National Archives in Denmark.
So I discovered clearly he's not a missionary, he was the governor.
For 5 years, that Engman oversaw the sale of captive Africans. He was on the board of the Danish slave trading company, and he owned enslaved people himself. That didn't keep Engman from also marrying an African, Ashokai, the daughter of a chief of the local Ga ethnic group.
Yeah, I think about Ashokai a lot. Yeah.
But the governor, so was he the guy like actually signing off on the shipments?
Yeah. Yeah.
Engman later returned to Denmark, but not before he and Ashokai started the Engman line in Ghana, the family line that generations later produced Rachel's father and Rachel. She's still trying to understand how she feels about being the direct descendant of slavers.
This will sound like I'm avoiding it, which I'm not really, but I think I need time to process this.
But finding that name in a way tied her to this castle. Rachel wanted to know more about it, and she was looking for a subject to focus on for her graduate studies. She went to the Ghanaian president to ask for permission to do an archaeological dig. We walk through the castle gardens. I see courtyards, fountains, a peacock, and clothes drying on a line behind the president's small house. We reach a trench and find Rachel's team at work. It looks like they've uncovered the foundation of a settlement.
Here, this started off as a 1 meter by 1 meter. So this is 5 years.
You've been looking at this hole for how many years?
Next month will be the sixth season.
Are there ever any of those moments you see in the movies where, you know, someone finds something and they, like, hold it up and everyone's like, oh, wow.
Yeah. We found bottles. I'll show you them. So this complete area down to there was bottles. And so we've left some of them in there.
Yeah.
You see this sticking out on the side of this wall? But when we first found that, we thought it's either two things, because there were a lot. It's either a ritual or it's a dumping ground. As we found more and more and more, we realized it's not a ritual because there was no other associated objects. So it was simply a dumping ground. But in terms of consumption, you know, a lot of soda water, tonic water, alcohol, spirits.
So are we looking at a building and these are internal walls or are they separate?
So we are still not sure, but we think they're rooms. At first I thought this was an external wall like this when we first started there. And then we realized it started going off into what seems to be rooms and then platforms. We haven't reached the bottom, but because I'm concerned about the wall, if you look over there...
She points to the uncovered remnants of an old limestone castle wall.
The wall has crumbled because we had the grass cutter, which is a bushmeat. It's like a giant rodent. People eat it. Yeah, so it like went in there and had a disco. It did that over here too. So, you know, I had to consult... There's a kid outside who like catches grass cutter and sells it. So I had to ask him to come in. I had to like seek consultation on how to like stop the grass cutter and what to do. So there's like me here and there's like this, you know, 10-year-old kid. You know, he doesn't go to school, so that's how he feeds himself. So I'm like, okay, what do I have to do?
Around us, Rachel's team is carefully scooping and sifting dirt, They're local men and one woman. Rachel's trying to recruit more. Many are direct descendants of Danish men who married women in the local Ga ethnic group. And these descendants bring their own expertise. For generations, their families have passed down oral narratives about what happened at the castle.
This gentleman here is a wolf from the wolf family, another Danish Ga family. This gentleman here is a swanaka, so another Danish Ga.
Rachel's hoping her team can use the skills they've learned here to get other jobs.
And so my hope would be that it can help create employment, because many of them have not worked since last year when we were here. Not a single day's work, because there are no jobs.
One of the team members, his name is Benjamin Odinke Annan. He lives in the neighborhood right next to the castle. We take a walk there.
We're right on the other side.
Originally a fishing village, decades later, it's now one of Accra's most impoverished neighborhoods. People who live here often don't get a formal education. Their homes don't have toilets. On the beach, there are dumpsters full of trash. The castle looms behind them. Benjamin's grandmothers had told him what happened there, but he said he understood much more by working with Rachel.
Because of archaeology, I've learned something.
Also, because of archaeology, he has more money. He's sending his three boys, Richmond, Jonathan, and Abe, to private school.
If you have something, then you have to push your children to go better school. I don't want them to suffer.
I ask Benjamin what he thinks about money being spent to unearth the past on one side of the castle wall, while on the other side, he and his community could really use the cash. He says if the castle's turned into a museum, as the government plans, it'll enrich the whole area, although Benjamin and other workers haven't gotten any guarantees. Still, he imagines his son one day seeing his name in the museum, saying he helped make it happen.
So everything is kept here because of tight security.
Rachel shows me the artifacts they've gathered so far that the government hopes to feature in the museum. They're sorted into labeled boxes in her office high in the castle.
So when they come up from down below, everything is literally a mixed bag. So you'll have all kinds of objects in here, and then we'll divide them up and categorize them. So we have local pottery there, smoking pipes there, more bottles, shells. So yeah, we have writing slate. So this is how they would have taught young children. There was a mulatto school here in the castle, so this is how they would have taught them how to write with a slate.
She's found items from Africa, Europe, and Asia. Some need to go to a lab to be dated. Others are as recent as the time period after Ghana's 1957 independence, when the castle became the seat of government for the new republic. But most of the pieces collected come from the Danish slave period. Some of these items were traded for people.
You know, everything would have come on the ships from there to here. Then humans would have been gone from here to the Caribbean or to the south. So they would come here, then they would refit the ship and then take them.
One day these pieces might help historians understand what the value of a human life was during the transatlantic slave trade.
I can put this under the microscope, and then I can track this trademark. So which country, which city, which town, which manufacturer.
The dig's funded by grants and awards from the U.S. Rachel's learned to do things carefully in culturally appropriate ways, like regularly visiting and updating the local chiefs. Everything she does reflects on her Ghanaian family.
But it's nice in that, seeing as I find all the funding, I can run the project the way that I think it should be run. So there's also freedom in that, which I really appreciate.
As we walk back to the dig site, Rachel explains that this project could help fill in the broad gaps in established history, an African history that's largely based on European accounts.
And because, you know, these are written by Europeans from a European white male colonial perspective, and they're also written for, you know, political reasons. So, you know, they're not going to mention a lot of things, or if they do, they're often in a negative way. But, you know, clearly they were having relationships with these people, because otherwise you wouldn't have members of my team with these Danish names, or myself with a Danish name. So, but, you know, they're never going to write
in the correspondence going back to Copenhagen, you know, like, oh, I married someone, or I shacked up with someone, or, you know, whatever. They're never going to write that, right?
The European accounts usually don't mention the Ghanaians who lived and worked with the slavers, or the thriving local community that did business with them. But the items Rachel's collected show they existed.
And so I think this is difficult for people to accept, because whenever people want to talk about slavery or slave trade, and we want to talk about African agency, it's always about resistance. And my project is not one of resistance. It's one of collaboration.
Some Africans acted out of self-interest and sold their fellow countrymen. Some Europeans both enslaved Africans and married them. Rachel says it may be easier to think that people who participated in the slave trade were simply bad or evil. But the truth is much more complex. For The World, Rupa Shenoy, Accra, Ghana.
We have photos of what Rachel Engman unearthed at Christiansborg Castle on our website. And while you're there, take time to read her first-person essay about combing through history in her archaeological digs at the castle. That's all online at theworld.org. Our series continues tomorrow when Rupa looks at the experiences of African Americans who are living in Ghana today.
We were constantly, my generation, trying to prove to white people that we were good enough, we were smart enough, that we deserved to be there. That was a huge big burden. We had to prove that to every white person we went, every job we had. But after I had gone through those castles, I didn't care what you thought. You just couldn't define me anymore.
The history had never really been taught. And what history was taught was very sanitized. It was a disaster. A lot of African-Americans were very disappointed to find this kind of blasé attitude.
That's tomorrow on The World. It was a funeral for a glacier. This weekend, about 100 people of all ages hiked up a mountain in Iceland.
It's a tough walk. It's only like 2.5 hours, but we had children with us, and my parents went with me, and we decided that, of course, there's no tradition of saying goodbye to a glacier.
That's poet Andre Magnusson.
So we were thinking, you know, how do you do it? And there's one tradition in Iceland of walking a holy mountain in the west coast of Iceland. And it has the rule you have to walk in silence. You may not look back. And if you do that all the way to the top, you will be granted 3 wishes. So that's what we decided. We went from the place where the glacier used to be, the periphery, into the center. We took the final walk, walking in silence, not looking back.
And when they reached their destination, they held a ceremony for the glacier that's the first in Iceland to lose its status as a glacier. A geologist issued a death certificate. Iceland's prime minister was there. A group of kids pressed a plaque into a boulder, including Magnusson's 10 and 13-year-olds. Magnusson wrote the words that were engraved on that memorial.
A letter to the future. Bréf til framtíðarinnar. Ok is the first Icelandic glacier to lose its status as a glacier. In the next 200 years, all our glaciers are expected to follow the same path. This monument is to acknowledge that we know what is happening and what needs to be done. Only you know if we did it. August 2019, 415 ppm of CO2.
Andre, what does it mean to you that this glacier has now been declared dead?
Well, this is a significant moment because Oak Glacier was one of the glaciers that we actually learned by heart in our children's school textbooks. So we would learn the biggest glaciers, but we would also learn about the smaller glaciers. And the main one with the strangest name was the Oak Glacier.
What does Oak mean?
That's kind of the special thing about what is happening, is that it's a peculiar name. It's kind of an archaic name of yoke. Yoke in English, that is the pole that you use to carry buckets of water.
Hmm.
Yoke also means burden or something that presses you down. So you could say the name is also symbolic because Ok used to carry the water, like all the glaciers of the world. But now that water is leaving the glaciers into the ocean, becoming the burden, the oppression of future generations.
What are the implications for the loss of Iceland's glaciers?
Well, Iceland's glaciers are actually huge. The thickest glaciers in Iceland are about 3,000 feet thick. And you can imagine three Empire State Buildings on top of each other. But these glaciers, if they were spread over the island, we would be under 100 feet of ice. So this ice is a huge mass. And when this mass leaves us, it will actually imbalance the Earth's crust and can cause volcanic eruptions.
So what you wrote is, we know what needs to be done and we need to do it. So what actually needs to be done?
We just need to transform all our energy production, and we probably need some kind of moonshot projects to search for the solutions. But much of it is just to do what your grandmother told you to do. Consume less or respect the material that we use.
Andre, is there a moment from yesterday's ceremony that sticks with you?
There was a girl that sent wishes to Greta Thunberg, the Swedish girl that is actually sailing in her boat, like deep south of Iceland, on her way to New York for the climate meeting in September. Mm-hmm. So suddenly you could feel this strange epic drama, actually, where children are on a mountaintop sending a message to a girl in the mid-Atlantic Ocean, to the country that has always been kind of leading the way, you know, going to the moon and doing lots of the cool stuff we have in the world, that has decided to not lead anymore. And you started to think that it was actually a time for maybe the Nordic countries to start taking more responsibility in the world.
Andre Magnusson is an Icelandic poet and author who wrote the engraving on the memorial plaque that now sits on what was once the Ok Glacier. Thanks so much, Andre.
Thank you very much.
Okay, time to lighten the mood with the world's Jonathan Dyer. Hey, Jonathan.
Hi, Carol.
So what do you have for us?
Well, I've got a joke. It's not my joke, and it comes from the Fringe Festival in Edinburgh.
That's a big deal, the Fringe Festival.
Oh, absolutely. It's billed as the biggest arts festival in the world. It happens every year. It takes up pretty much the month of August in Edinburgh. Try getting a hotel. There are thousands of shows. There's theatre, music, street performers. But comedy is really, really big. And some people just go for the comedy.
So this one joke, does the festival vote on a single best joke of the whole deal?
Absolutely. Each year, 10 comedy critics create a shortlist of jokes from shows that they've seen that they think are the funniest, and then the public gets to vote on that shortlist to come up with the funniest joke of the whole Fringe Festival.
Okay, drum roll. What is the funniest joke of this year's Fringe Festival?
Well, it comes from Swedish comedian Olaf Falafel. Can I say
Olaf
that again?
Olaf Falafel.
I'm laughing before I've even got to the joke. Let's get to the joke.
I keep randomly shouting out broccoli and cauliflower. I think I might have florette.
Oh, boy. Come on. Really?
It's puns. You know, Brits love their puns. We love our puns. We think they're punny.
But florets, it doesn't even completely rhyme with Tourette's.
I know, it doesn't matter. It's British humour. It's a little absurd. It's a little dry. And also, if it's a groaner, that doesn't matter.
It's kind of straying into dad joke territory, isn't it?
It kind of is, yeah. I mean, I think Brits like those jokes whereby you groan at it for a second, and then the humour gene kicks in, and you begin to laugh uncontrollably.
And I assume there's runners-up, or is there just one joke?
Oh, no. There's the shortlist, and there's 10 jokes on the shortlist in all. All these one-liners that you can read in 3 seconds. So can I get through as many as I'm allowed
to
by
our
producer? Okay, so this one at number 9, to be or not to be a horse rider. That is equestrian. And this one you kind of, I'll tell you the joke, you'll go, for 3 seconds, then it's going to kick in. A cowboy asked me if I could help him round up 18 cows. I said, yes, of course. That's 20 cows.
You know, I immediately got that.
Well,
I'm proud to say.
You're better at numbers than most of my colleagues in the newsroom then.
The world's Jonathan Dyer.
Oh, I haven't finished yet. Someone stole my antidepressants. Whoever they are, I hope they're happy.
That's enough of that for today. Ned Porter composed our theme music, and from the Nan and Bill Harris studios here at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. Thanks for listening.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, PRI, and PRX.